Well, welcome to week two of our 12-week study into the topic of apologetics. I have a mic this week, so this is pretty cool. And last week we talked about a couple things, and I just wanted to run over that. We do have the youth with us this week, so just wanted to make sure that not only you remember that, but also that the youth kind of get what we got last week. So last week we talked about what apologetics is. Noting that it's a well-thought-out, reasonable answer that satisfies any question or objection raised against the core doctrines of Christianity. We also saw that it comes in many different forms, not only defending God's existence, but also the resurrection, inerrancy, the deity of Christ, and more. Secondly, we saw why apologetics is important, noting that it's commanded and exemplified by Peter. We saw and looked through Acts how Paul did it extensively, and how Jesus did it to a scholarly level when he made a theological argument based off the verb tense of the original language. Second reason that we said it was very important is it's very relevant to the younger generation. If you'll remember, I retold a story of a girl who went to UNC Chapel Hill and lost her faith in a matter of 6 weeks. I spoke of Morgan Brown and some of the struggles that she's shared with me that she's had, and I've talked a little bit about the own personal struggles that I've had in my life. Dealing with this. The third reason we gave as to why it was important is that it prepares us for trials. It's easier to trust God when things go terribly wrong in life, when there's strong evidence independent of our own terrible experience that points to not only his existence, but his constant love for us. But we have to know that evidence before we face trials. Lastly, we kind of talked about how it was understandable, and anybody can get it. If you'll remember, I told of a Sunday school in Australia who taught 6 to 10-year-olds the classical arguments for God's existence. They were not only able to memorize them, but elaborate on them. So don't shortchange yourself. If they can get it, you can too. And if you don't get it, it's my fault. So stop me and slow me down and ask me to explain it better than I did. And keep this stuff in mind today, because it might sound like a little more facts today as we get into it. But we did spend last week talking about what this is and how it applies. And so we can't talk every class about how it applies. But I do plan to do a practical lesson or a practical application section at the end of each kind of big chunk of the course. So we'll get there. Even if we don't get to the practical application of these particular arguments today, we'll get to it a little later on. But you have to have the knowledge of the arguments, and I only have 40 minutes to lay them out. So then we'll get to the wisdom of how you apply it. And finally, our goals for the class that we touched on were threefold. One, learning to love the Lord our God more with our mind, meaning intellectually. Secondly, to be better equipped to fulfill the command and follow the example set in Scripture of apologetics. And thirdly, to be better prepared for trials that will come in our own lives. So those are our three goals for not only today, but for the rest of the class. Now turning to this week, we are going to cover two arguments for God's existence. The first, those being the Kalam cosmological argument and the teleological or fine-tuning argument. The Kalam cosmological argument, which is too long to say, so I'm probably just going to call it the Kalam. It's the argument from the beginning of the universe, and it is my personal favorite. It's the one I find most convincing, and it's the one that I think is set on the most irrefutable facts. So I just enjoy it, and I love talking about it. So I could not wait to get here to share this with you today. The teleological or fine-tuning is based on the fine-tuning of the universe, and we'll talk more about what that is when we get there. But it's often, the teleological is often referred to as the most convincing or best theistic argument by many atheists. So we'll talk about both of those today. These two arguments deal with cosmology and the universe around us. And so I would like everybody to turn to Psalm 19. This is a classic kind of passage for this topic. And when somebody gets there, could you please read Psalm 19, verse 1? Could you read that one more time? Thank you. Oftentimes we think of this verse as, I can look up and see the stars and the galaxies and think there has to be something out there bigger than myself. And while that's true and while that's wonderful, I think there's much more to it than that. And as we get into this, these arguments from cosmology, I think that's going to help explore that there's much more than just looking up and being impressed by the stars and saying there has to be something more out there. There can actually be reasoned arguments from the stars, if you will. And this is kind of known as natural theology, the theology we can get from general revelation. And so as I have my resident cosmology expert, Rick Perdue, here to my right, I think we're ready to get into this. So beginning with the Kalam, turn your Bibles to Genesis 1, and this will make Becky Shear very happy. Turn your Bibles to Genesis 1, and Dad, could you read Genesis 1, 1 to 5? Now, for over 3,000 years after these words were written, most of, if not all, scientists just dismissed them. That's because up until the last 100 years, the consensus among scientists was that the universe was eternal in the past and was without beginning. It wasn't until Albert Einstein presented his general theory of relativity in 1915, that people started to use his equations to predict that the universe might be expanding. In 1929, Edwin Hubble provided the first empirical evidence for this claim when he discovered that the more distant a galaxy is from us, the faster it appears to be receding into space. This means that the universe is expanding uniformly in all directions. Why does this matter, you ask? Who cares that the universe is expanding? Why does it matter that science has now discovered a beginning to the universe popularly known as the Big Bang? Well, I'm glad you're wondering, because it supports the first premise in the Kalam cosmological argument, which is the first one we're going to cover. The argument goes something like this. The universe began to exist. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe had a cause. Now let's look at that first premise that we were just talking about, that the universe began to exist. There's by universe, we mean space, time, and matter. And if you look at Genesis 1, the first words of the Bible are, in the beginning, time, God created the heavens, space, and the earth, matter. So when we're talking about the universe, I'm just simply meaning space, time, and matter. There are two types of evidence for the beginning of the universe, both scientific and philosophical, and we'll start with the scientific. The fact that the universe is expanding is our first piece of scientific evidence. We already talked a little bit about how we know it's expanding, but now we can talk about how it points to the beginning. And for this, I brought in a balloon because I thought this would be a good illustration. So I want you to imagine, let me not look down and talk it directly into the mic. I want you to imagine that this little balloon is the universe, and this is me at the beginning of time. Now, if I begin to blow this balloon up, it starts to expand, and I'm going to walk forward, and that's me symbolizing me walking, going forward in time. So if I keep blowing it up as I keep moving through time, we see that as time goes on, the universe keeps expanding and keeps getting bigger. Now, if I were to reverse time and I were to start walking backwards, what would happen to the balloon? It would get smaller and it would start to shrink down to the balloon being a final point. So we know the universe had a point of origin because when we see that the universe is expanding forwards in time, if you reverse time, similar to the balloon, you would see the universe begin to get smaller. And if you keep the same expansion rate of the universe, you get that the universe had a point of origin about 13.8 billion years ago. And so this is why the expanding universe is evidence for the beginning of a universe. Our second proof of this is there's radiant heat left out, almost floating is not the right word, but floating in space. And it's essentially the smoking gun of the Big Bang. It's the radiant heat left over from a massive explosion when the universe came into being. And a third piece of scientific evidence, though there is more, is the second law of thermodynamics, which is one of Rick's most quoted things. if the universe were here forever, it would have run out of usable energy by now. And an example of this, you might have learned in school that the sun is burning up. I know when I learned in like second grade that the sun was burning up, I thought that was going to be a serious problem I was going to have to face someday. But in reality, it's not. But the sun is burning up and will eventually burn up someday because it's a finite resource, right? It's going to run out. And so if that's the case, if the universe is infinite in the past, the sun wouldn't be here because it would have burnt up an infinite number of days ago. And so for the sun to still be here burning, that means it would have had to had a time where it started burning somewhere in the finite past. And so many other examples like this of us running out of usable energy points to not just the sun but other things, points to the universe having a beginning. So these are three reasons. The expanding universe, the radiant heat left over from the Big Bang, and the second law of thermodynamics are three scientific reasons as to why the universe had a beginning. Does that make sense to anybody? Does anybody get lost? Cool. Turning now to the philosophical evidence, this has been about much longer than the scientific evidence. As I said, it's only kind of been in the past 100 years or so that people really began to think that the universe had a point of origin, a beginning. But if you'll notice, the beginning of the argument, kalam, is actually an Islamic word that means to defend the truth of Islam. But in this case, it's just credited to a Muslim who came up with this argument. He came up with this argument in about 1000 AD, and he used philosophical evidence for the beginning of the universe. And philosophers have long recognized that there could not have been an infinite number of events in the past. This would include an infinite number of days, because an actual infinite produces logical absurdities. For example, let's imagine that you have a hotel, right, and there's an infinite number of rooms, okay? But every room in that hotel is filled. Now somebody comes in and checks in at the front desk and says, can I have a room? And so you bump somebody in room one to room two, from room two to room three, and you make another room in an infinite hotel that's already full. Now let's say you have an infinite a hotel with an infinite number of rooms, and all the people in the odd number rooms leave the hotel. So an infinite number of people leave the hotel, and you still have an infinite number of people in the hotel. So now we're subtracting an infinity from an infinity, and we're left with an infinity, and it produces a logical absurdity. All that to say, there can't be an infinite number of things in the past. And this actually is funny because I sat in the living room one night, I think, for about an hour and a half trying to explain this to Dad. Until I finally...
He's smarter
than all of us. Well, I couldn't
explain it like that. I
stuttered
the argument for all of you.
So... because I was all excited. I was pacing around the living room and I was like, Dad, you gotta get this. This is cool. Nevertheless, he finally did get it because I worded it in a way that made sense. But that's known as Hilbert's Hotel, and it was invented by a German philosopher in about the 1950s to show that infinities are logical absurdities and mathematical absurdities. And there's a lot of philosophical debate about that. But the thing that I find most convincing that the universe was finite in the past is that there can't be an infinite number of days. And this is what I was trying to explain to Dad that night in the living room, is that because today, May 21st, is here, there can't be an infinite number of days before it. And it took me about an hour and a half until I finally phrased it like this. Imagine an infinite day in the future. Could we reach an infinite day in the future? No. We can't reach infinite. So to somebody in the infinite past, May 21st, 2023, is that infinite day in the future that can't ever be reached. Does that make sense? But today has been reached.
Science is easier to understand than philosophy. Philosophy is in your head. Science can be proven.
Philosophy has proofs too. So I want you to imagine an infinite day in the future. Okay? Could you get to an infinite day in the future? You would never get there because there's an infinite amount of time between you and that day in the future. So you couldn't get there because you would just keep going on for infinity. And so to somebody in the past, we today are that infinite day in the future that they'll never reach. Except that we've reached it. But newsflash, that's the argument. That's the point, is today has been reached. Today has been reached, therefore the number of days in the past has to be finite, or we would have never have gotten here. Does that make sense to everybody? Everybody got that? I know it's a little hard to grasp, but that personally is what I find the most convincing for the beginning of time. Hilbert's Hotel.
I am trying to book a room, but I'm also wanting to do some research about it.
It's
theory. What was it called?
It's called Hilbert's Hotel.
Hilbert's Hotel, thank you. Not on Expedia.
No. No, it's not. So, concluding premise one, we've looked at scientific and philosophical evidence that have led people like Stephen Hawking to say, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. And one of his contemporaries, cosmologist Alexander Vilenkin, would say at Hawking's 70th birthday party, all, not some, of the evidence we have says that the universe has a beginning. In fact, Alexander Vilenkin was part of the Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem, which looked at models of the beginning of the universe and concluded that all models of the universe without a beginning ultimately failed. And thus the universe must have a beginning. And so oftentimes you'll hear about a Big Bang and how this is such like a great scientific fact. So that's another reason I really like this argument, is it seems to be very relevant. Now moving to premise two of this argument. This one kind of seems pretty reasonable. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Notice it's not everything that exists has a cause. It's everything that begins to exist as a cause. And this is kind of known as the law of causality. Many of you may have heard of that. It's both a scientific law and a philosophical claim. And it's a description of observed phenomena in the natural world. And it's the reason experiments can be repeated over and over, is because cause and effect is a regulated thing. Now, everybody experiences cause and effect in everyday life. We understand this concept. I was just telling Dad on the way here, we were talking about hammers and nails in an illustration. I said, if you hit a nail with a hammer, the nail immediately goes down into the wood. Or if you slip on ice, you immediately fall. Or if you sleep through your alarm, you're late for work. Cause and effect is something we experience every day. But nothing comes into existence without a cause. Sam Walton brought us Walmart. That's amazing. Steve Jobs brought us iPhones. Even more amazing. But nothing comes into existence without a cause. And this is pretty undebated as a scientific law. It's something foundational about how the world works. Now, the objection to this is that everything in the universe works like this, and the universe itself didn't have a cause. But that's some scholarly arguments. We're not going to get into that. But that leads us to the conclusion of this premise. So I want you to follow where we've been. We said the universe had a beginning. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. And therefore, the universe has a cause, which may not seem like a home dinger kind of slam dunk conclusion. And that text is way too small. I'm sorry you can't see it. But it is to me. And this is where the argument really comes together. Now, if you'll remember, I said when we talk about the universe, we mean space, time, and matter. So if space, time, and matter had a cause, the cause of space, time, and matter must be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial, not made of matter. Or as John 4 says, God is a spirit. It's not made of matter. He's an unembodied mind. Furthermore, this cause must be personal. It's not just like an arbitrary, you know, thing up in the sky that's like making things happen. The reason for this is that, as we talked about cause and effect, an effect always immediately follows its cause. Yeah, an effect always immediately follows its cause. You know, if I say something to Rick, that's the cause. He's immediately going to say something back to me. So the only way that a cause can exist without its effect immediately taking place is if that cause was a personal agent who could make a decision of when to create or cause the universe. Did you follow that? That was, no, I could lose people in that. That the cause of the universe has to be a personal agent. This also has to be very powerful because, I mean, you look at the world around us, you would have to be very powerful to create that, very intelligent to create something like we see in the world around us, and also singular. Since this being is timeless, it's infinite. And what makes two beings differ from one another is that one lacks something the other has. And an infinite being doesn't lack anything. Therefore, there can only be one infinite being, and therefore this being must be singular. So the scientific and philosophical evidence that the universe had a beginning and thus had a cause shows that the cause of the universe must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, enormously powerful, highly intelligent, and a personal creator of the universe. What would you ascribe to a being of such a description? God. That is simply what we mean when we say God. And that fit certainly possesses the traits of the God of the Bible. Now, this argument is extremely relevant, and I know the first time I heard it, I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. And it took me several months to fully grasp the argument and be able to explain it. But because the Big Bang is such like a relevant topic in our society, it really is a relevant argument. For example, there was this class two semesters ago that I was in, and we were talking about formal arguments and things, and some kid raised his hand, and he said, I'm an atheist because I guess I believe in the Big Bang and science and all of that stuff. And she says, we were just talking about how it, like, form arguments, and that was just his argument. And I was like, well, that was an interesting take. And so I raised my hand, and I said that my form of a deductive argument was the universe had a beginning at the Big Bang. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Therefore, the universe must have a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, and intelligent cause. And while that was in the middle of class, everybody seemed to like it. So my point is, this is very relevant, and you don't have to be afraid to engage with people on conversations about science or cosmology or the Big Bang, because we all believe in a Big Bang if you read Genesis 1. And it's actually evidence for God's existence, not evidence against it. So this argument is my favorite, as I've said, and I think it's very relevant to modern-day science and things.
You have to realize that people, what's the objection people have to the Big Bang? Well, I'll say Christians. Is it how long ago was it?
13.8 billion years.
And if you're a literalist from the scripture, the earth in its existence is maybe 10,000. So it's an argument that people use. Well, the Big Bang may have been it, but, you know, the Bible says it was 3-7 So it's something we have to be able to also defend our position of how, you know, because if you throw out the first chapter of the first book of the Bible, we've got to be able to make a defense for the statements that are there. So we have to be careful with saying the Big Bang as it's presented.
Well, the Big Bang model doesn't necessarily dictate that the universe is 13.8 billion years old. It just dictates that the universe had a beginning, which is what we're getting at. Dan and then... Yes. Right.
And so I think what you
And again, my point in using the Big Bang as a well-recognized model of the universe is to say that the universe had a beginning. I'm not saying how old the universe is, and in this class we're not going to talk about the age of the Earth or the end of the universe. Personally, I will just be open with my view. I don't necessarily hold to a young Earth creationism or an old Earth creation. I don't know where I stand on that topic, so I'm not going to stand before you and, you know, present a view and argue for one side. I don't think you're going to hell if you believe one or the other. I know very intelligent people who have argued over this for millennia. People who have believed the Bible, who have genuinely interpreted Genesis in different literary ways, and I don't think there's anything wrong with either one of those things. And again, the point isn't to try and figure out how old the Earth is. The point is to say that the universe had a beginning, and because it had a beginning, it had a cause. And because it had a cause, we can then deduce that it had this being out there that caused it, that has all of these qualities that we see on the screen. Does that make sense? Dad?
In your example, and this is to Julie's point, you had a college student who was an atheist because he believed in the Big Bang. And your side of the argument was, I believe in the Big Bang too, but it's from God.
I'm a theist because of the Big Bang. Correct, yeah.
And so we can use the Big Bang, which we do believe in the Big Bang. We've just kind of resisted that historically.
Because it has like a bad kind of tone to it.
Yeah, it's like a social connotation.
Right.
And we can use that to actually build the case for the creator.
So yeah, what I'm trying to say is we don't have to have this bad stigma that comes with the words Big Bang. Because it's evidence for a Big Banger, if you will. Somebody who caused this bang to happen. And so to Dan's point, if I'm talking to somebody who's an unbeliever who believes that the universe is 13.8 billion years old, I'm gonna grant that. And because if I grant that the universe is 14 billion years old, I'm not compromising the gospel, but it's one less thing I have to convince them of. Because if they come to believe that Jesus rose from the dead first, one, they're saved, and two, it's then much easier to get them to come to believe in a 6,000-year-old earth or whatever you want. But if you have to start knocking down the dominoes at, I gotta get them to believe the earth is 6,000 years old, I gotta get them to believe that the Bible's completely inerrant, and then I gotta get them to come to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. First, if we start with the resurrection, then they come to know salvation, and then you can convince them of those other things. And so I think sometimes we just get the order backwards. And so if somebody wants to believe the universe is that old, I'll grant that. I'm not going to sit there and argue. I'm going to say, hey, can we talk about more important topics to me that matter, like the resurrection or the implications of the universe coming into being. That unfortunately reminds me of Rick in Romans 1. I was just heckling him this morning about always referencing Romans 1. But you're right. People want to be their own God, and they want to take God out of it. And if you think I'm standing up here, you know, wanting, if you think I'm standing up here completely submitting to God 1,000% of the time, you're fooling yourself, okay? I'm not a teenage boy anymore. I'm a young adult male. Okay? If you don't think there's temptations that I have or things that I want to go do that are fun, you're crazy. Okay? Of course there are. But oftentimes, this evidence has honestly kept me from temptation many times because I look at it and say, well, this is true whether I want it to be or not. And so I got to follow it whether I want to or not. And so there is no wiggle room because I find the evidence so convincing. And so I'm like, well, this is true whether I want it to be or not. And eventually I come around to, you know, you want it to be true and stuff. But it helps me at least submit more. Did you have your hand up?
Well, it's going to be, well, Psalm 19 declares.
Okay, well, Romans 1, we're not going there. We're not going there.
What?
We're not
it's from what just Diana said. Humanity does not want God, period. So we have to realize that, and that's, science does not want God. In fact, they'll take the Big Bang and go back a stage and say, well, the Big Bang came from the intersection of two other universes, and off they go. All you got to do is, well, what was before that? They refuse because they want to suppress the truth about God in spite of the evidence. They don't want to hear it.
Correct. And then you just get into an infinite regress of causes, and we already talked about how that can't happen. Brad, could you click the next slide because my clicker isn't working? Cause and effect. That's true. Maybe it's a computer error. Did you have your hand up, Alan? Yeah. Yeah. Correct. And that's not to say that God doesn't have a triune nature. He's one being in three persons, which is an important distinction to make. Right. So, now moving along to the teleological argument, or the fine-tuning argument, and we're running out of time, but that's okay, this one's shorter. This, as I said earlier, is often considered to be the best theistic argument by many atheists, and it kind of goes like this. I need to make this text bigger. The universe is finely tuned for the permission of life to exist. The fine-tuning is either due to chance, physical necessity, or design. The fine-tuning is not because of chance or physical necessity. Therefore, the fine-tuning of the universe implies it was intelligently designed. And so what the fine-tuning is not is not that, oh, this animal looks specifically designed for its climate and it looks really smart and there's a lot of cool things about this animal looks designed. Because the response you're going to get to that is, oh, well, evolution made that and it was just a natural process, not intelligent design that made this animal. What we mean when we say finely tuned is physical properties of the universe around us, not necessarily the animals in it. So examples of this would be Stephen Hawking saying that if the expansion rate of the universe was different by one part in 100,000 million million, 1 second after the Big Bang, the universe would have either collapsed back in on itself or never developed gravity, galaxies. So, we talked about how the universe is expanding. Stephen Hawking, who we showed the picture of earlier, I'm sure all of you heard the name, he said that if the rate at which it is expanding is different by one part in 100,000 million million, 1 second after that first initial explosion, the universe would have collapsed back in on itself or never developed galaxies, and there would be no life. Another example of this is the force of gravity. If it were off by one part in 10 to the 40, our sun would not exist. So that's one with 40 zeros behind it. On a scale as wide as the entire known universe, that's 1 inch. One in 10 to the 40. So there's a number of these physical properties, not just these two examples, but there's a number of them that you can't just get one of them, right? You have to get them all. You have to hit all of them to hit the cosmic lottery, if you will. And so if you start multiplying those together and getting the odds of hitting all of them, that becomes a very, very slim chance. And so that leads us to our second and third premise, that all three possibilities of this are physical necessity, chance, or intelligent design. Physical necessity, the properties of the universe could be different because we found that the properties of the universe are independent of the laws of nature, which is a long thing I'm not going to get into. But the physical properties of the universe could have been different, so it's not because of physical necessity. So that leaves us with chance or intelligent design. I don't have enough faith to believe that all of these things were just imputed into the universe to make it life permissible. Again, this isn't something that could have evolved because the expansion rate of the universe is put in right there, 1 second after the Big Bang. So that's not something that you could evolve and get right over time. That had to be right the first time. And so you either go with the astronomical chances of that happening and being right, or you come to believe that the universe was intelligently designed. Now, how people get around that is there's this thing called the multiverse. Has anybody heard of the multiverse? Not you. The multiverse is essentially that there's millions and millions of galaxies or millions and millions of universes, and we just happen to be in the one that's finely tuned. This violates Occam's razor, which says that you take the most plausible, simplest explanation. What's more simple? An unembodied mind that created this universe, or that there's millions and millions of universes and we just happen to live in the right one? The fact that there's millions and millions of universes is kind of a lofty explanation to try to explain this away, and it seems a little ad hoc. So it's often accused of violating Occam's razor. Yes?
There's also no evidence of...
Yeah, that's the other thing.
I mean, they make it up in order to eliminate the necessity of the intelligent design God.
Yes, so, yeah. Right. So, yeah, this is then what the argument kind of looks like. I shared two of those kind of fine-tuning facts with you, and there's many more. If you want to kind of go look up the fine-tuning of the universe, you're going to find things like that. And so the best explanation of those is that the universe is intelligently designed to permit life. So we've covered two arguments today. The Kalam cosmological argument and the teleological or fine-tuning argument. The Kalam, if you remember, it goes, everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. And we talked about the qualities of that cause that, to me, make that argument so appealing. We talked about both the philosophical and the scientific evidences for the beginning of the universe. We talked about why it's reasonable to think that everything has a cause. And we said that the cause of the universe must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent, and singular. Then we talked about the fine-tuning of the universe. We gave some examples of it, that being the force of gravity and the expansion rate of the universe, and how the odds against those things having to be correct was astronomically low, and you need to have all of them hit and be correct. You can't just have one of them do it. And we said that it was due to intelligent design, that that was the most likely explanation, because physical necessity doesn't necessarily apply, and chance is just too difficult to believe. And while there are alternative explanations, we didn't really get into those because I didn't think they would really fit this class. There are alternative explanations to explain the fine-tuning, but ultimately, intelligent design seems to be the best explanation. And we met our three goals for this course because we learned more about God, not through his direct revelation, but through general revelation. As we read Psalm 19:1 in the beginning, the heavens are telling the glory of God and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Those verbs are in present tense. They're currently telling and currently declaring the works of his hands. And we noticed that how those things in our universe do that. And these arguments kind of explained those things. It meets our second goals because, like I said, about the kid in my class who was talking about the Big Bang, it helps us connect with others and connect with unbelievers. And when you're talking to unbelievers, Alan gave me a book, and it said when you don't have to convert somebody in a conversation. When you're having a conversation with somebody, the idea is you want to put a stone in their shoe. You want to give them something to think about. And if you know these things, all of a sudden you can put a stone in somebody's shoe. Was I going to convert that kid in my class? Absolutely not. But if I sit back there and say, well, the Big Bang is evidence that there was a da-da-da-da-da-da-da cause of the universe, that puts a stone in his shoe, and all of a sudden we're thinking. So these arguments and facts are meant to provide you with information that's relevant to modern science that can help you put a stone in somebody's shoe while you're talking. It meets our third goal because, at least for me, these arguments have helped me through times that I've struggled and doubting in my faith, and I'm like, well, my life might be tough right now, but, you know, the universe still has a beginning, and that's kind of where I go with that. And so those are how it meets our three goals. Are there any final questions or clarifications anybody wants to ask? Well, then next week we'll begin with what's known as the moral argument for God's existence. Thank you.